The third case for oral argument this morning is Carol Thornton versus the City of Rapid City. For the appellant is Mr. Timothy Becker, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, Thornton is Robin Zephyr, an attorney also from Rapid City. Mr. Becker, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Zephyr. On behalf of my client, Officer Tony Harrison, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to come and present our oral arguments today to you on this case. Judge Merton Tice, the trial court judge, dismissed all the claims that were presented by Mr. Yellowboy against the City of Rapid City and against the Rapid City Police Department. Judge Tice, on summary judgment, also dismissed all the claims against Officer Tony Harrison except two claims: assault and battery and a violation of civil rights. The assault and battery claim brings into play a South Dakota statute that gives Officer Harrison the privilege to use necessary force while in the performance of any legal duty. The claim of violation of civil rights brings into play the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which provides us all with the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And today, what we're talking about here in this particular case is the right to be free from unreasonable seizures. As this is an appeal from a summary judgment motion, we take Mr. Yellowboy's facts as being undisputed. And those facts, if I may, I'd like to review those for you.
That would be helpful.
Thank you. In the early evening hours through the evening of June 21st, 1999, and into the early morning hours of June 22, 1999, there were numerous calls to the Rapid City Police Department, reports of disturbances at 820 North Haines in Rapid City. During this time, in the evening hours of the 21st and the early morning hours of the 22nd, Mr. Yellowboy, who at that time was 15 years old, was playing at a friend's house, playing PlayStation games. Early morning hours of June 22nd, he decided he would walk numerous blocks to a convenience store to get a can of soda, and then was going to walk home, which again was numerous blocks. At 2:24 a.m., June 22nd, Officer Tony Harrison received a call from dispatch reporting destruction of private property and a fight with 30 to 40 people in progress at 820 North Haines. He was in that area, dispatched. He was there within about 10 to 20 seconds. The way that he arrived at the scene was through an alley behind 820 North Haines, which runs north and south. He entered the alley at the south end, drove his patrol car to the north. As he drove up the alley, he saw about five individuals fleeing from behind 820 North Haines, running north up the alley. He noticed that a wooden fence that's about 6 feet tall, that he'd been there enough times, he realized that this fence is usually up. It's a big fence. But there was a section of this 6-foot wooden fence that was knocked down. A resident from 820 North Haines was standing in the alley behind his home, pointing north up the alley. Officer Harrison stops his car by this individual, is getting out of his car, and the individual says, "There they go." Officer Harrison pursues the fleeing individuals on foot. The individuals get to the north end of the alley, which is Van Buren Street that runs east and west. The individuals take a right, run about a half a block to Wood Avenue, take a left, run about a half a block north on Wood Avenue. As they are running north on Wood Avenue, Mr. Yellowboy is on the sidewalk walking to go get his can of pop at the convenience store. The group of individuals that are fleeing the scene run closely around Yellowboy. And Mr. Yellowboy then appears out of the back of the pack. Officer Harrison, Mr. Yellowboy says he feels a force on him. He goes down on a concrete driveway and breaks his wrist. There's also testimony that's a tackle. He's tackled on the driveway and breaks his right wrist. He's handcuffed with his hands behind his back. He's walked back to the north end of the alley behind 820 North Haines, and he's stood up in spotlights, is what he calls them, and apparently the people at 820 North Haynes tell the police officers he's not involved in the destruction of private property, he was not involved in the fight. So the officers take the handcuffs off, put him in the police car, and take him home to his mother. Based on those facts, Officer Harrison has been sued by Mr. Yellow Boy for assault and battery. And with that claim, South Dakota law sets up a privilege for Officer Harrison. It's found at South Dakota Codified Laws 22-18-2. That says to use or attempt or offer to use force or violence upon or toward the person of another is not unlawful when necessarily committed by a public officer in the performance of any legal duty. That brings two questions for us to look at. Officer Harrison was in the performance of a legal duty, and was the force he used necessary? Under this court's decisions and under the decisions from the United States Supreme Court, Officer Harrison was performing a legal duty. When he has reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, he has the duty to pursue and detain individuals that he believes have been involved in that criminal activity. Let's take a look at the facts that give him that reasonable suspicion, that put that legal duty on him. 2:24 in the morning, it's dark, he's the only one in his police car, it's the first one on the scene. There's been a report of destruction of private property, report of a fight, 30 to 40 people, in progress. He's there in 10 to 20 seconds, very quickly. So things are still hot. The individual who is at 820 North Haynes is pointing, says, there they go. He pursues on foot. It's his duty. It's a part of the job that is not a safe part, probably not their favorite part, but it's his duty. So he pursues the individuals. He's got the legal duty to do that.
But how about the second issue? How about the second test?
Yes, the second part. Was the force used necessary in the performance of that legal duty? And that part is the tackling of Mr. Yellowboy. That's what we're here to talk about today. Those same facts point to, yes, that force was necessary. It's 2:24 in the morning, it's dark, he's the only officer on the scene at that moment. He's there instantly, fight in progress, 30 to 40 people, a very volatile, hot situation. He sees them fleeing. The fleeing individuals closely go around Mr. Yellowboy. Mr. Yellowboy comes out of the back of the pack. Mr. Yellowboy, by his own testimony at that time, was 6'3", 235 pounds. Officer Harrison tackles him and puts the handcuffs on him.
Were they going the same direction? Was Yellowboy going the same direction as the fleeing, or was he going the opposite direction?
He was going in the same direction, walking north, and the fleeing individuals were going north on Wood.
Was he running?
He was walking.
Did the officer ever yell, stop, this is the police, I'm armed?
Absolutely not. There was no verbal communication from Officer Harrison of any kind.
So he ran up behind a walking man and tackled him. Fair statement?
That's correct.
Okay, isn't there a genuine issue on the fact then as to whether or not that's reasonable force, necessary force, or excessive force?
No, that's not a genuine issue of material fact. That is a legal question under this statute for the trial court to decide. And I'm appealing, saying that that was an incorrect decision on that legal question, asking this court to reverse Judge Tice.
But in a way, I mean, if he could have yelled at him and told him to stop, then isn't it unnecessary or excessive force? There's other means available for him to bring the person to a stop, at least worth trying, right?
In hindsight...
And I realize this is hindsight, but even looking at it at the time, you know, this man was walking, the rest of them were running away.
But as Officer Harrison testified, this is quite often the case. After you run a little ways, there's always one that comes out of the back of the pack and is tired, has quit running, is walking. Sometimes they even go down before he gets to the individual. They figure out that I've been caught, and they lay down, they fall down.
But he didn't. He was tackled.
That is correct. In this case, he was tackled, according to Mr. Yellowboy's testimony.
Tackled the easy one, because the others were running.
Yeah, and the officer, no officer is going to pass the easy one to go catch somebody that's still running. They're going to stop the first one that's available to them to detain them and talk to them about who were the other individuals, what happened, try to get to the bottom of the crime. Correct. But the force here...
Since they usually, as he says, since they usually lay down on their own, become exhausted or whatever, then doesn't it make more sense to, you know, walk up to him and say, you know, stop, I'm a police officer, I want to talk to you?
In hindsight, I would agree with you. We wouldn't be here today if that had happened. But in hot pursuit, under the circumstances, things evolving quickly, this had been report of a violent crime, and this individual is a big individual, 6'3", 235. He made the decision to tackle, and did tackle. And Mr. Yellowboy says it broke his wrist. And he handcuffed the individual, told him he was under arrest, took him back, and then once they found out that he was not involved in the destruction or the fighting, he was released. But the force here, he was performing a legal duty, and the force was necessarily committed in that legal duty.
Help me remember the relative ages.
Mr. Yellowboy is 15 years old at this time.
And the officer obviously is an adult.
He's an adult. I would just guess probably would have been in his 30s about that time. I don't think that's part of the record. If he was asked in his deposition, I forget what his age is.
So if you're saying it's a matter of law and we rule against you, then what is the ruling? What would that mean then? As opposed to a question for the jury.
Well, if we go back to the jury and we're done with summary judgment, then I get to present my facts also. Okay. And then it does become a question, a fact for the jury to decide. I'm presenting the case, best case scenario for Mr. Yellowboy in front of you today. It doesn't get any better than this for him. That's what makes it a legal question. We have undisputed facts. May I move on to the qualified immunity portion?
Please do.
Thank you. Mr. Yellowboy also has a claim for violation of civil rights against Officer Harrison. That brings into play the Fourth Amendment, and under the Fourth Amendment, the use of excessive force has, there's been tests set forth by this court and also by the United States Supreme Court, a three-part test. And the first part of that test asks, did the plaintiff's complaint allege a violation of his constitutional rights? And we've said yes. We admit that his complaint in this case alleges a constitutional violation of the Fourth Amendment. Second part of that three-part test says, were the constitutional rights clearly established? And for purposes of this appeal, we have said yes. That has also been met. Fourth Amendment at the time of this incident, 1999, clearly established that you could not use unreasonable excessive force in detaining an individual. The third part of the test is what we're here to talk about today, and that's would a reasonable officer understand that at the moment, on the scene, not in hindsight, would he understand that what he was doing violated Mr. Yellowboy's constitutional rights? And I submit to you that the answer to that question is no. Again, we've got the early morning hours. We've got a 15-year-old individual who's out in the streets at 2:24 a.m., the report of destruction of private property, fight in progress, 30 to 40 people, a volatile situation. Officer saw the destruction of the fence, heard the there they go, sees them fleeing. Fleeing individuals go closely by Mr. Yellowboy in the same direction. He comes out of the back of the pack, and he's a big individual, and he's tackled. And that is a reasonable officer on the scene, not in hindsight today like we're talking about, but an officer on the scene having that information would say that's not a violation of Mr. Yellowboy's rights. The United States Supreme Court in Graham versus Connor, I quoted it in my brief, I'd like to reiterate that. With respect to a claim of excessive force, the same standard of reasonableness at the moment applies. Not every push or shove, or even if it may later seem unnecessary in the peace of a judge's chambers, violates the Fourth Amendment. The calculus of reasonableness must embody allowance for the fact that police officers are often forced to make split-second judgments in circumstances that are tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving about the amount of force that is necessary in a particular situation.
But even, you know, that's the law from the United States Supreme Court, but even under that opinion, they use a three-part test. And wouldn't you agree that based on the severity of the crime at issue and whether the person poses an immediate threat to the safety of the officer or others, both of those two elements are missing in your case?
The severity of the crime, we've got a destruction of private property and a fight in progress, 30 to 40 people, he's there in 10 or 20 seconds. I think that the severity of the crime is playing a key factor in the mind of the officer, Harrison, and also in the reasonable officer.
Well, it's not a bank robbery or a murder, or it's nothing relatively serious.
I agree with your description that in comparison to a murder or bank robbery, that it's a lower degree crime than that. But a destruction of private property and a fight in progress, officer at that time didn't know if individuals had been hurt bad, not hurt at all. He's there to do his duty, and that is to try to apprehend and detain individuals to figure out what went on, who committed the crime, and prosecute them if possible.
Well, then what about the second factor? Because it didn't appear to me that Mr. Yellowboy was an immediate threat to the officer or any other person.
I agree with you. The second factor from Graham versus Connor is not there. The third factor, fleeing individuals, is there.
So essentially you have one of the three
factors. I believe that we've got two of the three, the first factor and the third factor. Severity of the crime, and we've got individuals fleeing. Now, in hindsight, as we sit here today, we agree that mistakes were made, two mistakes. Number one, detaining an individual that was not fleeing from the crime. And number two, detaining an individual that was not involved in the destruction of private property or involved in the fight. But that's, in hindsight, we see those mistakes. Qualified immunity is there to protect officers that make those good faith mistakes. That's why I'm asking you to reverse Judge Tice's decision and provide Mr. Harrison with qualified immunity.
Let me ask you about the mistake. I thought it was interesting in your briefs that you focused almost entirely on making a mistake with respect to whether it was the right or the wrong person who was tackled. But isn't the question really whether or not he made a mistake in the amount of force that he was used, considering the circumstances of this case?
I look at that, rather than a mistake, I look at that in the reasonableness context, that it was reasonable, and once I get beyond the reasonable context, it doesn't fit in my category of a mistake that qualified immunity is there to protect the officers for. So I guess I put the mistakes and the tackling conduct in separate boxes. But I can see where one could argue that those should be looked at together.
You have 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. Under the assault and battery claim, I'm asking this court to reverse Judge Tice's. Officer Harrison, I believe, is entitled to summary judgment based on SDCL 2218-2, the privilege that he has to use the necessary force to perform his legal duties, that being apprehending and detaining individuals and using force if necessary, as decisions of this court and the Supreme Court have allowed him to do. And as for the violation of civil rights claims, I'm asking this court to reverse Judge Tice. Again, qualified immunity is there to protect officers such as Officer Harrison when his conduct was reasonable, and a reasonable officer would not understand that what Officer Harrison did violated Mr. Yellowboy's constitutional rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. I fail to note that Justice Konenkamp of our court has disqualified himself from this matter, and that the Honorable Robert Miller, a former justice of this court, has been appointed to sit in his place. Mr. Zephyr, you have 20 minutes, sir.
evening, justices, or afternoon. May it please the court, my friend and opposing counsel, Mr. Becker. It's always an honor and privilege to appear in front of the South Dakota Supreme Court, and especially on a case of this nature with the important issues involved. I know that this particular case was set for non-oral argument determination, and that was switched approximately a month ago, so we appreciate the opportunity to share additional information with the court. I must admit that this is the largest audience I've appeared in front of it before the court. It's a little intimidating. I must admit I have a bit of a stage fright, but I'll maintain. As I stated, this is an important case. I appreciate the arguments put forth by opposing counsel. However, the arguments presented by my client, Mr. Yellowboy, who was 15 at the time, a young Native American young man living in Rapid City, I believe are paramount to this court's concern. I'm speaking, of course, of the Seventh Amendment, the right to for every citizen in the United States to have a trial in front of their peers to determine issues of fact. Now, I think that the court in question, Judge Tice, when he heard this case upon motion for summary judgment on qualified immunity grounds, I believe he made the right decision. We conceded many claims in that process. We had claims initially, excuse me, of negligent supervision, negligent training, negligent hiring. For good faith principles, we saw that we did not have the evidence to support that, so we knowingly conceded those claims at that hearing and proceeded directly with the individual claims against Officer Harrison, since he was, in our mind, the offending party. When I speak of the Seventh Amendment, justices, I speak of this from my heart. I speak of this as a citizen of this country, as well as a member of an Indian tribe within this state. In this particular case, obviously, I'm representing a young Indian man. He, for whatever reason, was a victim of circumstances. This motion was filed by Mr. Harrison, Officer Harrison, asking that this court look at a certain version of the facts. And under the summary judgment standard, under Rule 56, the version of facts concerning my client walking down the street at 2:24 a.m. Near a scene where the police were called is what I'm speaking of.
Mr. Becker said that the facts don't get any better for your client than he just recited. Do you take issue with that?
I do a little bit, Justice. Okay. There are differing versions of even the best version. Essentially, I believe we pattered this around in our briefs somewhat, but Mr. Yellowboy, certainly he was 15 at the time. He didn't have a stopwatch with him. He made estimates during his testimony as to whether how long it took for the individuals that ran by him along the sidewalk, the time when they passed until the time he was tackled from the back. And that ranged from anywhere from 5 to 30 seconds. Now, I think that's important because even if you used in that sense the best version put forth by Mr. Becker and his client, we're talking about 5 seconds. 1001. 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,005. Now, with an individual walking down the street, minding his own business, not doing anything, and then to be tackled in the manner in which he was, this is why we feel we needed the force of law to pursue claims for damages, and he was damaged, there's no doubt.
Now, he was tackled from behind, correct?
Yes.
So the officer wouldn't even have seen his face when he tackled him?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Becker is correct that my client, he's a large person, and he was large then. He was 6'3", between 6'3", 6'4", and he weighed about 230. And on that particular day, he was wearing shorts and a t-shirt and sandals. Now, I think in the sense of examining what this court needs to do de novo on looking at the issue of whether excessive force was used and whether Officer Harrison tackled my client, I think it's important for the court's consideration to know that Officer Harrison, again, according to my client's testimony, hit my client in the upper part of his back and took him down to the ground in a manner where his right arm was sticking out at this angle, trying to support his body, and with Officer Harrison's body on top of him, this is what caused the break in his wrist. So I think that's an important consideration when it's looked at to determine the amount of force that was used in this particular detention. And this was a detention, clear and out. It was both a stop and a seizure, all in one. Obviously, the Fourth Amendment protects a citizen from an unreasonable seizure. Not only was Reinhard seized at that particular moment, but he was very soon after arrested and cuffed.
Should the officer be given the benefit of the doubt in the sense that here's a 15-year-old boy who's 6'3", 230 pounds, and he's out at 2:24 in the morning or whatever, and he's walking down the street? I mean, is this a mistake on the officer's part, and he ought to be given the benefit of the doubt because your own client, you know, kind of walked into a mess where a lot of things were happening, and all of which was then the officer didn't know about?
I appreciate your question, Justice Sabers. All I can say is boys will be boys. The fact that my client was out at that time, obviously he shouldn't have been out. He did not know where he was even coming in close proximity to the situation that was going on. I think that what Officer Harrison was confronted with at that moment surely was a very intense, over-emotional moment for him, that as a trained police officer pursuing somebody he did not really know what he was pursuing them for exactly, but with all of that excitement, and he even admitted that he was excited at the moment, that it is possible to make a mistake. But in the sense of taking the deliberate and intentional action to physically tackle somebody who is walking, not running, but walking, that is more than a mistake. That goes against training. That is not the actions of an objectionably reasonable police officer under those circumstances. Again, I appreciate Justice Zinner's question regarding the severity of the crime at question here. Reinhard was not charged with any crime. He was released as soon as they could get somebody to identify that he wasn't involved.
Are there any manuals from the Rapid City Police Department or any evidence at all in the record as to what type of training the officer receives in apprehension in these types of situations, or was he just simply on his own?
No, there is training. And there is a brief cite to that, Justice Gilbertson. In my brief at page 17, I believe there was an exhibit also attached to my brief. It was the Rapid City Police Department rules and procedures concerning their policy on the use of necessary force. That is in the record. That was minimally discussed at the time of the motions hearing in front of Judge Tice. Officer Harrison did admit that he had been on the force for several years prior to this, and that he had gone through all of the necessary and requisite training. Again, we had additional charges, claims against the city for negligent training, negligent supervision, negligent hiring. When we got the information through discovery, and learned more about what the city had actually put Officer Harrison through, we conceded those claims. We did not think that they were justifiably brought at the time of the motions hearing, and we conceded those.
What do the police department regulations say as to the use of force under those circumstances, if you'll read it?
I will, Justice. Under definitions, under number one, the definition of force, the actions an officer takes to stop potentially dangerous and unlawful behavior, to protect the officer or another from injury or death, to protect subjects from injuring themselves, or in the process of effecting lawful arrest. That's the definition of force. I think it's also important under the policy provision, use.
Do they define unreasonable force or excessive force?
It defines use of necessary force. And that is defined, the policy of the Rapid City Police Department is that officers shall use only that force that is reasonably necessary to overcome resistance from a person being taken into custody, to stop an assault of a third person in self-defense, or as reasonable and necessary to perform their police functions.
Perhaps you've answered this question. It's not clear from the briefs to me, and I haven't had a chance to look at the record yet, but the City of Rapid City and the Rapid City Police Department are no longer in this litigation. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Did you argue to Judge Tyson that the officer had alternatives? Clearly he had to do something to, you know, you just couldn't let your client walk away.
Right. I did. I was prepared to argue that, but the judge brought it up first.
Oh.
And so we.
What did he say?
Well, I believe it was a question to Mr. Becker and asking, we were talking about the Saucier case and the circumstances that were involved in that involving protection of the vice president and such. Judge Tice asked Mr. Becker whether or not there were alternatives, whether he could have just yelled at him and told him to turn around and identify himself, but obviously none of that happened.
Could you address for me the significance of the fact that we're dealing with a privilege question in the course of summary judgment? You used the word honest mistake a little while ago, and the purpose of the privilege, the qualified privilege that is given to police officers, is to basically give them the benefit of the doubt if it's an honest type mistake.
I understand. I would disagree to the extent that they have a clean, good faith shield for all honest mistakes. I think if that honest mistake reaches the level of bordering on incompetent or being a purposeful or intentional or deliberate violation of their own trained policies, then that honest mistake is actionable and should not be protected by this privilege. I think this privilege and the rule itself, the purpose that it was given through the Congress and then through the courts, was a very noble purpose. However, and I probably went a little bit long in explaining some of the things that I feel as a practitioner involved in many of these cases of how possibly the procedural rule is somehow swallowing the remedy. And that frightens me, and I hope that frightens our citizens. That's why this is an important case, is because where there are factual disputes on whether an officer carrying out his duties may have used excessive force, we hope that we can trust the citizens of our country to make that determination when they hear the facts. And this rule, if used for purposes of denying or prohibiting citizens from appearing in court before juries, is in fact a dangerous tool. And when we look at the possibility of somebody not having a remedy when they are injured in this nature, I think that furthers the purpose of a very, very serious examination of the question on a genuine issue of material fact. And we would just ask that this court give deference to what had happened there, even though you do have a de novo review of the situation. We believe that Judge Tice made the right call, that this is a jury determination on whether the force used that particular night on Reinhard Yellowboy was in fact necessary and reasonable. We obviously don't think that it was. This young man suffered a very serious injury. He continues to suffer, and yet he's never really had his day in court. And we are looking forward to that day. And we know that Mr. Becker and his client will put their best case forth. But I certainly believe that we need to trust the Seventh Amendment and our citizens to be able to decide these issues. Were there any other questions from the justices?
I believe not.
I don't have very much.
We don't punish anybody for quitting early.
Okay. Well, thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Zephyr. Mr. Becker, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I'm sure I'll quit early. Okay. Just a couple of points. We understand the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial, and we don't want to take that away from anybody. We're all entitled to a jury trial in front of our peers.
Aren't you kind of inclined to take it away from the client, the patient?
Yes.
Plaintiff here?
Yes. We have special circumstances that this court has recognized and that the United States Supreme Court has recognized for our police officers. They're out there every day busting their tail ends dealing with individuals in society most of the time that you and I would not want to deal with. And they are allowed early on in the trial process to ask for qualified immunity before it gets very far.
But why shouldn't that question be submitted to a jury in the state of South Dakota under these facts?
The question of qualified immunity?
The question of whether or not there should be liability in this situation.
Because it is clear that a reasonable officer on the scene under these circumstances would find that what Officer Harrison did not violate his constitutional rights. Reasonable officer under those circumstances could do the same thing.
But there seems to be quite a bit of doubt around here, so I'm saying why not submit it to the jury? What reasons do you have for not submitting to the jury, assuming it's not as clear as you say it is?
And that's the argument from Mr. Yellowboy. Let it go to the trial. My argument is it is clear that he is entitled to qualified immunity because his actions were reasonable. And a reasonable officer with all those facts in mind of what was going on that night, not hindsight, but what was going on right then, it was reasonable for Officer Harrison to do what he did. And it was not a violation of Mr. Yellowboy's rights. And the process that has been set up allows us to take a look at it in these early proceedings like this and say, you know what, that officer was entitled to qualified immunity and we are going to kick this claim out. And that's to help the officers so that they're not drug into the courtroom for every arrest for an assault and battery claim. I wanted to make one comment on the use of necessary force policy and procedure with the Rapsay Police Department. It's important to note that it's a clause set up with the word or at the very end, and the last thing that is listed there is as reasonable and necessary to perform their police function. So it comes back to the same language that we were looking at under SDCL 2218-2, necessary force. And again, I submit that it was necessary under these circumstances and authorized.
One question. Would that last sentence that you read trump the sentence that was read by Mr. Zephyr, that necessary force, it's only necessary force if it's used to overcome resistance? There was no resistance here, was there, on his part?
That's correct. There was no resistance on his part other than he was viewed as being a fleeing individual, which I was talking with Justice Zinter about those factors out of Graham versus Connor, is the fleeing individual is one of those factors to look at.
Do you view that there are any procedural differences in the way we should look at a claim of qualified immunity under the state statute versus 1983 and the federal precedent under 1983?
I struggled with this question early on when I was starting to brief, and I can really discern no distinction. There's no case law in our state that gives us direction on how do we determine necessary force. Do we have a three-part test like we do under the federal constitution for Fourth Amendment excessive force cases? And we have no guidance. It seems to fit into the state statute privilege that you can look at what is objectively reasonable under the circumstances. But we have no guidance from past decisions of this court to say definitively that this is the test. Does that answer your question, Justice Inter? Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.